So today I'm going to talk about a chiral operator on a hypermultiplet moduli spaces. This is the work with Amichai Hanani and Sergio Benvenuti. Both of them are at Imperial College. For part one of this talk, I would like to introduce a quantity called the Hilbert series, which give new information about the moduli space of supersymmetric gauge theory. So this is going to be the first part of my talk. Okay. So what's the motivation for this object, the Hilbert series? So I focus on supersymmetric gauge theories. And every supersymmetric gauge theory has a collection of chiral operators which form a chiral ring. And chiral ring contain information on the structure of the possible operators in the theory, as well as the relation they may satisfy. And the Hilbert series, the two I'm going to talk about, count the chiral operators in the theory. So let me give you an example. And later, I'm going to talk about the application of this object, Hilbert series. Okay. So the punchline is that I want to talk about a partition function. So an object that will give you new information about moduli space. So let's start from, we start from a very trivial example, and we move on to harder and harder examples, okay? So let's take a theory with one free chiral field. I call it phi, okay? So the chiral operator in this theory, you just raise it to the power k, okay? Where k can be 0, 1, 2, blah, blah, blah. And there is a conserved U1 charge in this theory. And suppose that phi carry unit charge in this U1. So phi to the k carries charge k. This is natural. And if I introduce a chemical potential for the charge, let's call this mu. And I define a fugacity T such that T equal to e to the minus mu. So you can see that the fugacity for phi to the k just t to the k, right? You raise it to the power k. You can construct something like a partition function by summing the t to the k from k equal to 0 to infinity. So here, this is partition function. And you get, this is a geometric series, so you get 1 over 1 minus t. And this is an object called Hilbert series, okay? And as a property of the Hilbert series, the pole at t equal to 1 of this rational function is the dimension of the moduli space of the thing you're studying. So in this case, the pole at t equal to 1 is of order 1. So the moduli space is 1 complex dimensional. And actually, as you can see, because it's parametrized by this guy, which is a complex field, the moduli space is just C. It's a complex line. And this series, or this rational function, is actually the fingerprint of this space, C. Okay, so this is a simplest example of Hilbert series, how you construct Hilbert series for this simple theory. Then let's move on to less simple theory. So if you have n-free chiral field, phi 1 to phi n, so chiral operator, you just raise each of them to the power of k. So k1 up to kn, where k1 to kn run from 0 to infinity. Now, the global symmetry is going to be un. And there is a collection of maximal commuting u1s in the un. And if we assign the charge fugacity ti for each u1 to the field phi I with I from 1 to n, you can construct Hilbert series in a similar way by looking at this. So T1 to the K1 up to Tn to the, sorry, this should be Kn. And you sum over all K1 to Kn from 0 to infinity. What you get is that it's a product of rational function. Okay? As I wrote here. But the question is, in this form of Hilbert series, okay, you get this kind of product. But how to make the UN symmetry manifest in this problem? This is what I want to pose. So basically, in order to make the UN manifest in this problem, you rename the fugacity as follows. So you rewrite the fugacity Ti as follows. So T1 equal to Tx1, blah, 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 up to Tn equal to this. Now, you have two type of variable. You have T, this is the U1 fugacity, and you have X1 up to Xn minus 1. These are the SUN fugacities, or if you like, it's the weight of the SUN algebra. Okay? So, with this, you plug it in here, expand it. Let's look at some first two terms. First term is 1. And the second term is one, T times this guy. And this guy, if you recognize it, is just the character of the fundamental representation of SUN. Okay? So in here, okay, let's make the notation more compact here. Let's use the highest weight notation or the Dynkin label to denote the character. So 1000 is going to be the character of the fundamental representation of SUN. And in general, I'm going to use the Dynkin label K1 up to Kn minus 1 to denote the character of SUN. And if you do the full expansion of this, so i.e. you plug in here, into here, and you write it in closed, well, for infinite sum, you see that you get an infinite series, where the coefficient is the n000. And this guy is the nth symmetric power of the fundamental representation. This somehow, well, it's not surprising because you have collection of field, right? You raise it to the power. You're supposed to have a symmetric product. And this is what you expect. So with the charge n, the chiral operator transforms in the representation n000 of the global SUN. Okay? And this is the nth symmetric power of the fundamental representation. Now, this guy. There is a way to write this in a compact way using an object, which I'm going to define in the next slide. It's called a plethysmic exponential. So let me tell you what this object is. It's just a way to write this object nicely. Is there any questions so far?
To the counting of all the states?
To the...
Is it independent between H, or do you have to actually count all the operators to get H?
So basically, you asked me, is there any way to get H?
Without going through the counting of all the operators.
Oh, okay, yes, I will present that. Yeah, you see, there are some way to do that. But let me get you all the tools that I need, okay? So, let me define the plethysmic exponential. The word plethysmic comes from the word plethora. Too many. So yeah, this is a word actually used by mathematicians, representation theorists as well. So they might use the word plethysm. Okay, the plethysmic exponential. So the definition of this is if you have a function of multivariable function, ft1 to tn, vanishing at the origin, i.e. f000 equal to 0, the plethysmic exponential, or PE, is defined to be exponential of this guy. So you raise all the parameters inside to the k divided by 1 over k and sum 1 to infinity. Well, if you look at this, let me give you some example. Suppose you take ft equal to t. The plethysmic exponential, you put t to the k into here, you see that it's going to be Taylor series for the law. And exponential of the log is just 1 over 1 minus t. Okay? Now, suppose you have a power series like this, you're going to get something like this. Now, the important thing is, if you take plethysmic exponential of this guy, you can see that this guy have a variable x1 up to xn minus 1, and you have t. You put it into here, you raise it, you're going to get this infinite sum. What this tells you here? So if you put this fundamental representation, right, under this exponential, what it generate? It generates the sum over n symmetric product. So basically, I conclude here that plethysmic exponential generates the symmetrization. Okay, so this is the tool that I'm going to use heavily in this talk. Now, for those of you who are familiar,
with this object in statistical mechanics. This is the bosonic partition function. Basically, if you have boson and you want to construct partition function for various number of boson, you do similar kind of thing. Yeah.
So, okay. Right. Let's come back to the N3 kind of chiral field. So you can see that this guy can be written as platistic exponential, as I show you. And if you set N1 equal to Xn equal to 1, so you set all the SUn fugacity to be 1, you get this guy. And if you remember from the previous slide, 1 over 1 minus t is a Hilbert series of C. So, as you expected, the moduli space is C to the n, right? So 1 over 1 minus t belong to C, and this is just C to the n. And if you look at the order pole at t equal to 1, it is n. So the moduli space is n complex dimensional, as expected. Okay? So this is a simple application of the Hilbert series. Okay, are there any questions here? Okay. Right. So I would like to move on to first application of a Hilbert series. So I want to study chiral operators on the instanton moduli space. So how do we do that? So let's first of all, before talking about instanton, I would like to summarize a bit about n equal to 2 supersymmetry. And you will see the connection why I have to start with this. Okay? So, first point is that all n equal to 2 theories have an SU2R symmetry, which act on the two supercharges of given chirality. And the content of n equal to 2 supersymmetry is the following. So let's start from the gauge field. So it's grouped in the what we call n equal to 2 vector multiplet. So this vector multiplet contains gauge fields, two wire fermions, lambda and psi, and a scalar phi, all transformed in the adjoint representation of the gauge symmetry. Okay, this is how I write it. And in this way, SU2R symmetry acts on the row, basically. So it's act on here as a singlet, transform lambda and psi as a doublet, and phi as a singlet. And this phi is going to play quite an important role later. This is a scalar field in the n equal to 2 vector multiplet, okay? And in terms of n equal to 1 supersymmetry, you can group this, A mu and lambda, as a n equal to 1 vector multiplet called W alpha. And you can group this guy, psi and phi, in a chiral n equal to 1 chiral multiplet, big phi, okay? And the matter field lives in the hypermultiplet. So consisting of two wire fermions and a complex boson, Q and Q tilde, dagger. And as usual, SU2R symmetry act on the row. So that's a singlet here, doublet here, and singlet here. And you can group this into n equal to 1 as Q and Q tilde. Okay, so this is a short review of n equal to 2 supersymmetry. Now, what has something to do with instanton? Let's look at the simplest case of a KSUN instanton on R4. So, let's consider the setup first. Basically, I would like to propose to study the following setup. So, let's just look at the world volume of D3 brain probing the D7 brain. So, basically, I start in the type 2B. Okay? So, it has 10 dimension, R19. I put D7 brains and put D3 brain. Since it's a D brain, so string ends on it. So you have a fundamental strings end on D7 and D3. And in this setup, okay. Let's first suppose that I don't have D7 brain, what you have. You just have KD3 brain, right? What's the world volume theory for KD3 brain? It's a UK n equal to 4. Super young males in 4D, right? Now, if I put D7 brains on, N D7 brains here, since these D7 brains are heavier, So basically, it gives rise to the SUN, global symmetry on the world volume of the DC brain. So in this picture, if you don't have D7, you have UK gauge group coming from here. But you put D7 on, it becomes a global symmetry. All right? And let's count supersymmetry. So you start from 32 supercharges. You put one type of brain in, you go down to 16. And you put another type of brains in, you go down to 8. Make half each BPH object, make half supersymmetry. So if you look at the world volume of the D3 brain, you have 8 supercharges in 4D. And this is N equal to 2. Okay? This is why I give you introduction of N equal to 2. So it's N equal to 2 supersymmetric gauge theory in the world volume here, in the 3 plus 1 dimension, with the UK gauge group and SUN flavor symmetry. And this can be summarized nicely using a quiver diagram. So if you look at this guy, the circular node denotes the UK gauge symmetry. The square node denotes the SUN global symmetry. And the fundamental string stretched between D3 and D7 represent the bifundamental hypermultiplet, represented by a line here. And the position of the of KD3 brains here, well, the position on the direction of D7 brains is represented by an adjoint field. So the VEF of this adjoint field is actually the position on the direction in the world volume of D7. Okay, so this is how I represent this picture as brain picture, as a field theory picture. So you can see it's very direct. Okay, so this is the D7. ND7, this is KD3, this is the F string, and this is the adjoint hyper. Okay, any questions so far? Right. Now, if I look at the moduli space of this gauge theory, there are two branches of moduli space. The first is called Coulomb branch, and the second one is called Higgs branch. I'm going to start on Coulomb branch, which is irrelevant for my talk, later talk, but it's worth mentioning anyway. Okay. Let's first consider this, the case where D3 brain are separated from the D7 in the transverse direction of D7. So D3 brain are outside the D7. This is a Coulomb branch. And, the vector multiplet acquire VEF. And this VEF is actually the position of the D3 transverse to D7. So you have D7, D3. And the position here, transverse to D7, is the VEF of the vector multiplet. Since it is acquired VEF, the UK gauge symmetry is broken down to U1 to the K. Okay? And by Higgs mechanism, the hypermultiplet become massive. And there will be some massless field left. And these massless field are charged under this U1 to the K. And they experience Coulomb interaction. And that's hence we call it Coulomb branch. Okay? This is the first branch. The second branch is when D3 brains are on top of D7. So you put them together. All right? So what happened here? So, as you can see, when you put D3 on top of D7, the fundamental string become tensionless, and hence the hypermultiplet become massless and acquire VEF. And the UK gauge symmetry is completely broken generically at the generic point on the Higgs branch. And by the Higgs mechanism, the vector multiplet become massive. Okay? So, yep. And in this case, as you can see, when the D3 brains are on top of D7, if you become an observer on the D7, you look at this, you will realize that D3, you see the core dimension 4 object, which is actually the KD3 brain, right, on your world. So in this case, the D3 brains, the KD3 brains, are instantons as viewed from the D7 perspective. So you see the core dimension 4 object here. Right. So I propose that the Higgs branch is the moduli space of instanton. And in this case, you can see it's a K-SUN instanton on R4, as I proposed. Okay? Right. Are there any questions so far? So we get into the instanton moduli space by looking at the Higgs branch of this system. And the argument goes even further. Let me tell you about some Eddy-Sham construction. Okay, this has some history. So in the 80s, mathematicians want to study this object called instanton. And this is even long before we talk about quiver and n equal to 2 supersymmetric gauge theory. And there are four mathematicians who propose an instanton equation to describe these instanton. They call there are four people here. So RTR, Drinfeld, Hitchin, and Manin. It's the construction of this solution is called the ADHM construction. Now, in that paper, if you look at their original paper, it's very interesting because the abstract has only one line and one sentence, actually. It says, we construct instanton from linear algebra. But if you look at it, the detail that they analyze their instanton equation, they use twister theory. And I think the more natural way of like physicists, especially for string theorists, to look at the instanton equation is to look at it from field theory point of view. You get the same equation. So I propose to look at this theory, this field theory, the n equal to 1 quiver, okay? N equal to 2 quiver. But before I'm doing any computation, I would like to translate the data of n equal to 2 data into n equal to 1 language. So as you observe in my short summary, the two copies, right? So for in n equal to 1 language, what I have to specify is, of course, gauge group, matter fields, and superpotential. So how do I do that? Okay, so look at this. Circular nodes is a gauge group, so UK gauge group. Now you have SUN flavor symmetry, carry down. You have a bifundamental hypermultiplet, and this become two chiral multiplets, Q and Q tilde, if you can remember from the summary. And this guy, so basically the rule is, if you have one line n equal to 2, it's become two lines with opposite direction in n equal to 1. This is what I did here. Now, this line also become two lines, phi 1 and phi 2. Okay? And you also have scalar in an n equal to 2 vector multiplet, the phi, which is here. I have to write it down here. But if you want to focus on Higgs branch, let me remind you, for Higgs branch, the vector multiplet become massive. Basically, this guy live in n equal to 2 vector multiplet. So the VEV of this scalar is 0 in this one, okay? So since you get a 0 VEV of phi, the only non-trivial F term, basically F term is just the derivative of superpotential with respect to the chiral fields. The only non-trivial F term would be the derivative of W with respect to the big phi here. So what you get this equation. This is the F term. And you can write now the usual D term for this gauge theory. It's look like this. And precisely, these are the ADHM equations for K-SUN instanton on R4. So we can get the ADHM equations by looking at F and D term, which are the field equations of a supersymmetric gauge theory. Okay. Now, what about other gauge group? So, well, you can talk about K-SUN instanton. What about S-O and S-P? You can do similarly. And the ideas come from Douglas in 95 and Witten, 94 and 95. So basically, what you need to do is that since you want SP or SO, you just put different type of oriented fold on top of D7 and then put D3 on those background. So for SP, you put consider a system of K D3 brain with N D7 brain on top of O7 plus. What you get is this become SPN, and the gate become ON, and this loop become S, and where S is the hypermultiplet in the rank 2 symmetric representation of OK. And similarly, for SO, you just put this type of oriented fold in, you get SON, where the gauge could become SP, and you have this A, where A is the rank 2 antisymmetric field. Again, you can proceed the same in the same story. F and D terms are the ADHM equations. Okay? Are there any questions so far? So these are how you obtain the ADHM equations from the gauge theory. Okay? Right. Now, the harder one is when you go on to the classical exceptional gauge group instance on R4. First of all, no ADHM construct, no known ADHM construction for this theory. So basically, you have, well, the theory become harder. You have no ADHM construction. And if you track down, basically, you can construct a similar picture to this. You put G here as an exceptional group, and this red blob denote a theory with unknown Lagrangian. Well, at least for E6, E7, and E8, the blob denote a theory with unknown Lagrangian. So basically, that is a theory. And it is now known that those theory are conformal field theory, a conformal at the very strong coupling. So basically, you can't write down a Lagrangian in a weak coupling limit where you can do perturbative expansion.
Consistent field theory for it?
Yes. And this theory, okay, the field theory, you can propose it, and you can even write down Seiberg-Witten curve on that. And this is done by Minahan and Nemeshchansky in 96. Recently, it can be this theory can be realized. This is due to Gaiotto in 2009. But this theory can be realized on M5 brain wrapping Riemann surfaces. And for example, if you want an E6 theory, so basically if you want E6 here, what do you have to do is that you put three M5 brain wrapping a Riemann surface with three punctures. And if you do this, what you have is the following. So you have a Riemann surface with three punctures, and you wrap it. Each puncture, since you have three M5 brains, each of them will give rise to three SU. Basically, each of them give rise to SU3 global symmetry. You have three of them, so you have SU3 cube. But this SU3 cube enhances to E6. Hence, you get CFT with the E6 global symmetry. This is an example how you get E6. You can do similarly for E7 and E8 by considering similar construction. However, so far, there is no known corresponding theory for F4 and G2. So this is the current status. Basically, so the no ADHM construction is equivalent to there's an unknown Lagrangian of the theory, basically. I can't draw the quiver diagram in analogy to these theories. This is the problem. However, the main point of this talk is that even though we have no ADHM construction, no Lagrangian, we still can ask the question, what's the set of the chiral operator on 1G instanton moduli space? And I would like to show you today how to obtain the spectrum of chiral operators for G equal to A, B, C, D, E6, E7, E8, F4, and G2. And E6, E7, and E8, F4, G2. There is no ADHM construction, no Lagrangian. But you can still compute the operator, the spectrum of chiral operators on that. What's the method I'm going to use? I'm going to use Hilbert series, of course. And you can see that we can start from the easy case by, quite easy, A, B, C, D. Once you get the Hilbert series,
You can see that there is a natural way to generalize that to E6, 7, 8, F4, and G2, very naturally. So let me show you how to do that. So let's start with one SUN instanton on R4. You draw the same quiver again. Now I use n equal to 1 language, n equal to 1 notation. So since it's one SUN instanton, k equal to 1, I have U1 gauge group here. And SUN flavor symmetry. And what about the matter? I have quark anti-quarks as usual, phi 1, phi 2, and big phi. And this is the super potential. And let me remind you again that we are on Higgs branch. So the VEF of this guy is 0. Okay? This guy becomes massive. The global symmetry is SU2R times U1R times UN, come from the flavor. And as I showed you before, phi 1 and phi 2 transform as a doublet in the global SU2 here. Now, the Hilbert series is the following. This is how you compute it. And let me show you, it looks like a mess because it's two lines. But it's actually a very simple idea. I can show you where each part comes from. Okay, let's look at this. Let's look at the second line first. You have PE. If you remember what I told you earlier, what PE does is you put field together and it generates the symmetrization, right? So basically, you just put all of them in here. So what do you have? First, you have quark. What quarks mean? It's an arrow that go out from U1 and ends at SUN. So these arrows mean Q carry charge 1 with respect to this U1. And if I denote Z for the gauge U1 fugacity, this is Z here. Okay? It carries a global U1 charge T. Okay, so I have TZ. And it's the incoming arrow to SUN. So this is the anti-fundamental representation of SUN. So this is the highest weight notation. Okay? So we are done with the quarks. Now, let's look at the anti-quark. You can do in reverse way. So, since it's an incoming arrows to U1 gauge here, it carry charge minus 1 with respect to this gauge group. So you have Z to the minus 1 here. Okay? It carry charge 1 with respect to the global U1, so T. And since it's the outgoing arrow from SUN, it's a transformed in the fundamental representation of SUN here. Okay? Now look at phi 1 and phi 2. These guys transform as a doublet under global SU2. So here is the doublet. Carry charge 1 and the global U1. So you have it here. Now you symmetrize all of them. But this is not the end of the story. You have F term come from here. And you can see if you take derivative with respect to big phi, you get something quadratic in relation. So it's Q tilde Q equal to 0, right? And this F term can be encoded here in the Hilbert series. Now, is this the end of the story? No. Since you want a moduli space, you talk about gauge invariance operator. I haven't talked about D term, and I have talked about modding out by gauge symmetry yet. By solving D term and modding out by U1, this is known to be equivalent to modding out by symplectic quotient of complexified gauge group. And this is what you do. Integrating over the group. And this is the harm measure, basically. So this is you integrate over this, and you get what you want. Now let me show you the result. So after performing integration, you have the following Hilbert series. This Hilbert series is a product of two things. Let's consider the first thing. The first factor, if you remember this, it's actually the Hilbert series of the space C2, right? With the X here, you know, the global symmetry here. So basically, C2 here is R4 here. So it's a translational degree of freedom of the instanton. And you have infinite sum here. This is a non-trivial part. So you have translation and something. And this tells you, actually, the spectrum of the chiral operator on the 1SUN instanton moduli space. So what does it tell you? It tells you that the chiral operator, which carry U1 global charge to N, transform in the N0000N representation of SUN, where 10001 is the adjoint representation of SUN. So basically, just say that at order 2N is transforming N times this. So this is the punchline of this computation. So you count chiral operators to all orders, as you can see, because it's an infinite sum. And you can tell in which representation that this object transform in the global symmetry, in the flavor symmetry. And it's actually N times this guy, okay? N times the highest weight of the adjoint representation. And if you look at the dimension, H11, you set X all X's to 1. And you have HT1101. As T goes to 1, you have this, 1 minus T to the 2N. This means instanton moduli space is 2N complex dimensional, or N quaternionic dimension. And it actually, to the previous knowledge, if you remember, let me talk about a special case of 1SU2 instanton. This is the case where, like, people on R4, where people most familiar with. So in this case, if you plug it in, you get 4 complex dimensional. Okay? This means it's 8 real dimensions. Some people prefer to talk about this 8 degree of freedom as follows. So you have, first of all, you have 4 translation. Mode on R4, right? So your instanton can move on R4. You have 1 size of instanton. And since you talk about winding number when you talk about instanton, you can talk about 3 embedding of SU2. So this is the dimension of SU2. So you have 4 plus 1 plus 3, you get 8. And this is the way to generalize it. This result is known and is agreed when you do this. So this is a check, if you like. And you can generalize this to 1G instanton on R4. So what do? You compute the same for A, B, C, and D. What you get is a very similar thing. Can you see that? The first factor, again, is a Hilbert series of C2. This signifies the translational mode on R4. The second non-trivial part is, again, telling you that if you denote 0, 1, 0, 0, 0 as the adjoint representation, the chiral operator carry charge 2N, global charge 2N, transform in N times this guy, and you call it to order. Okay? So this is the power of Hilbert series. I propose to generalize this to all compact semi-simple groups, so A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And as a check, you can perform dimension counting. So you set all x to 1. You let t goes to 1, and you get this guy. And what does this tell you? It tells you that the moduli space of 1g instanton on R4 is actually 2hg complex dimensional, where hg is a dual Coxeter number of g. And this agrees with the known result. You can perform so many non-trivial checks here. For example, since you can use recent technology called algebraic cyber duality to perform the check of this case for exceptional groups. And we have done this in our paper, and it's agreed correctly. Okay, so this is the Hilbert series for any 1G instance on R4. Okay, this is a punchline for this part. Are there any questions? Okay. If not, I would like to go ahead to another part of my talk. This is related, but not connected. So, this has a funny name. It's called Trivertices and SU2s. This work is the work in progress. We hope to get it out soon. And right. So,
What do you learn from the Silbert series beyond just the complex dimension of moduli space?
So the purpose is to count the chiral operators in the theory to all orders, right? So this is the first thing. So I propose that this is the way the chiral operator transform. If you want to count how many, you just take the dimension of this representation. Then you notice how many chiral operators are there at that level.
Well, okay, but does the Hilbert series contain any more information?
Yes. For example, this is not part of my talk, but you can have a look at our works. For example, it can tell you whether the moduli space is Calabi-Yau or not. And it's quite simple. Basically, you write Hilbert series as a rational function. You look at the numerator, and you look at the coefficient in the numerator, whether they are palindromics or not. If they are palindromic, it is Calabi-Yau. It's like a magic fact, but it has been proven rigorously. So it contains actually some geometrical information on the space that you're studying. You even can compute the degree of the manifold or the variety using the series, and the method is described in our work. So yeah, it has some information about it, and I would like to say that the second useful thing about it, as you can see, Hilbert series can be used to check whether two theories are dual to each other or not. Well, it's not a proof of the duality, of course, because we are at a level of chiral ring and a field theory.
But it's a non-trivial check, because you count operator to all order, you look at how operator transform in global symmetry, and if they agree on both sides, you can say with some confidence that two theory are kind of dual to each other. And we use this to check a lot of theory in the context of M2 brains, the theory that lives on M2 brain. So this is also part of our work. And you can see that the third part, I will have some duality to propose as well. Okay, let's proceed. You have any more questions? Okay, if not, I would like to introduce you a class of n equal to 2 supersymmetric gauge theory in 4D. And this class of theory can be represented by graphs consisting of two ingredients. This graph is due to Gaiuto in 2009. The motivation comes from his work called N equal to 2 Dualities. So, this part of the talk is going to be a subset of his theory, of course. But I will show you that with this class, you can compute some interesting result. And I'll show you those results, okay? So, it's represented by a graph consisting of two ingredients. First, consider a line. So you draw a line. And this line is actually an SU2 gauge group with a gauge coupling proportional to the length. Well, the gauge coupling 1 over G square proportional to the length of the line. And of course, if you have a line with infinite length, this is the SU2 global symmetry. Okay? And I propose another ingredient, which is a trivalent vertex or a node here. It's connected with the three lines here, okay? It represents 8 half-hyper multiplets transforming in the trifundamental 1, 1, 1. So representation of SU2 cube. If you're not familiar with this highest weight, it's a spin a half, a half, a half in the SU2 cube. So each of them is a doublet, basically. So doublet, doublet, doublet in the SU2 cube. Right, because it connect with the three line, okay? And this class of graphs have a define a unique Lagrangian. So basically, when you write one graph and this define a unique Lagrangian of n equal to 2 gauge theory in 4D. Let me give you an example of this graph. Here you are. So one can classify the graph using the genus G and the number of external legs E. Okay? So let's look at the simplest case. There is a node here and three lines here. So what is this theory? This theory just consists of 8 free half-hypermultiplets, okay, in the global SU3 cube, because these lines are infinite, okay? This graph, G equal to 2, E equal to 4, so genus 0 and 4 external legs. What is this theory? So you have how many gauge group here? SU2 gauge group, one SU2. And you have 4 SU2 global. So this is actually nothing but SU2 theory with four flavor. Okay? And now, when you come to higher genus, like G equal to 1, E equal to 2, you have more than one graph that you can draw. And these theory are dual to each other. Okay? So this one and this one. And of course, these theory are different. And G equal to 2, E equal to 0, these are the examples. These are the theory that you can write down. And it has been known that a theory with the genus G and external legs can be realized on the world volume of two M5 brain, wrapping a Riemann surface with genus G and E punctures. This is by Gaetano in 2009. You can realize this in type 2A as well by considering a system of NS5 brain and D4 brain. So basically, the setup is as follows. So you have two NS5, and you have D4. So what you do, you lift this theory in type 2A to string theory. Oh, sorry, to M theory. When you lift it, D4 become M5, NS5 become M5, and so you have the geometry. There's some kind of the concept of genus, and you have the way you should think about it is you have M5 brain on those Riemann surface with the genus and the punctures. Okay? Now, so in this case, if you like, mm-hmm. So the D4, you ask me?
Yeah.
So it's actually the gauge symmetry, if you like, living on the D4. So basically, the strings that stretch between D4 is the hypermultiple that you write down.
No, is the idea that these two NS5s that you have drawn, those are the two M5 that you are talking about?
Yes. When you lift it to M theory,
what happens to these D4s?
You lift it, then you get M5.
Yeah, but then it seems like there are more M5 than just two in the picture.
Oh yeah, this is in generic picture. You can talk about any gauge group.
Oh,
but in my talk, I would restrict to only SU2 gauge group and SU2 global symmetry. Okay? Now, let's do some computation on this graph. You can, by induction, you can say that, okay, if I draw this kind of graph with genus G and E external legs, what you have is 3G minus 3 plus E SU2 gauge groups. And you have 2G minus 2 plus E nodes, i.e. you have 2G minus 2 plus E matter field. And each node corresponds to 8 half-hypers. Okay? So this is the first result that you can get from drawing this graph and compute it topologically. Now, in order to do computation, it's easier to look at it from n equal to 1 language. You can write down superpotential from this graph by sum over all the nodes, where the nodes, each contribution for the nodes is you have two Qs and one phi, and you contract with two epsilon. So in this way, you have a cubic superpotential, and you sum. Okay? So this is how you write down n equal to 1 superpotential. And, okay, are there any questions so far? So this is the structure of the theory, what you have, matter fields and gauge groups. Now, what I'm interested in, what I would like to focus on in this talk, is the hypermultiplex moduli space of this class of theories. Okay? So let me compute something. Right. Let's start with a theory with genus G and E externally. So focus on the branch on which hypermultiplets are massless. So basically, the hypermultiplet moduli space is the moduli space parameterized by the VEF of the hypermultiplet. Now, how many degree of freedom are there in total? So you have this number of nodes. Each node contains 8 half-hypers. I would like to count it in the quaternionic degree of freedom, so I have to times a half. So you have a half times 8 times this, quaternionic degree of freedom of hypermultiplet. Now, if you have a theory with genus G, there are G massless U1 vector multiplet at generic point on the hypermultiplet moduli space. You can compute this by looking at the F term. Okay? And so the gauge symmetry is not completely broken. So you have SU2 to the 3G minus 3 plus E. It's generically broken to U1 to the G, but it's not completely broken. That's why I avoid the term Higgs branch here. The word Higgs branch is conventionally used when the gauge symmetry is completely broken on a generic point of the moduli space. Okay? In this case, it's not. Now, you can compute by using Higgs mechanism that you have 3 times this minus G quaternionic degree of freedom of vector multiplet that become massive. Okay? Now, you compute the massless, the leftover massless hypermultiplet degree of freedom. So what do? You take this and subtract this. So you get E plus 1 quaternionic degree of freedom are left massless. So what does this mean? It tells you that the hypermultiplet moduli space is E plus 1 quaternionic dimensional. This simple computation agrees with another method by Benini, Benvenuti, and Tajikawa, 2009. And you can see that it depends only on the external leg, not the genus. So if you have genus 0, you have 1 quaternionic dimensional. If you have E equal to 1, you have 2 quaternionic dimensional. All right? So this is how you compute it. Now let me give you more detail for a particular example. Let's take a tadpole theory. This looks like a tadpole, right? It has SU2 gauge group. This is a loop here. It's a line, yeah? And it has a SU2 global symmetry. And suppose I use the index AB for gauge group and alpha beta for the global symmetry. You have 1 node. And this node transform into trifundamental. But since this is a loop, you have AB here. I apologize for this comma. This is not a derivative. This is the way I split two set of indices. Okay, so Q alpha, AB alpha. You can analyze this half hypermultiplet into, there are two parts. So you can see that you can contract with epsilon because you are in SU2. The invariant tensor of the theory is as epsilon symbol. So you contract it, you get X alpha. And these are SU2 singlets. So you have 2 SU2 singlets. Alpha run from 1 to 2. Okay? And if you subtract the trace part of the Q, you got SU2 adjoint. You got 2 of them, because alpha run from 1 to 2. And if you compute the F terms, it tells you that the adjoint commute. So basically, this theory, you can look at this theory as the following. As the SU2 gauge theory, because SU2 gauge group, and since all adjoints are commute, you get n equal to 4 gauge theory. Now, you have the extra thing, it's the x, it's a free hypermultiplet. This is written in n equal to 2 notation. Now, I know that some of you might have objection, because in pure n equal to 4 gauge theory, it doesn't have a free hypermultiplet. So some people might call this theory n equal to 2 star. It's the only difference is that it has a 2 singlet here, and it doesn't participate in the interaction. So it's free singlet, okay? So now let's look at the Higgs branch of the hypermultiplet moduli space of this theory. So you've got x's. You have 2 x's. Then they're free. So they're parameterized C2, okay? 2 complex field. Now look at this guy, M alpha beta. You can make it gauge invariant by taking a trace, right? Alpha beta. And if you compute the determinant, you get 0. This thing is nothing but the orbifold of C2 mod Z2. So you conclude that the moduli space is actually C2 mod Z2 times C square by this. The C square is parameterized by X, and this guy is a C2 mod Z2. You can compute Hilbert series using the method I mentioned previously. The result is the following. Let me show you what each component means here. So you have PE. Again, this is a symmetrization of the fields you have. Now, if you look at this, the T, carry charge 1, this is the X, right? And transform as a doublet of the global SU2. Yes, because you have 2 X and you have index alpha. So this is here. And you have there's something carry charge 2. This is a phi 1. This is phi alpha, phi beta. And transform as a triplet in the SU2. Okay? This is because of this. And you have one relation at order 4, which is the determinant sticking here. So disagree with what we analyzed earlier. And the purpose of this talk is not to just give you simple example. We want to generalize the Hilbert series to any G and E. So give me any graph, I can compute the Hilbert series for you, for any G and E. Okay? So how do I obtain this? The aim is to obtain Hilbert series for a theory with any G and E. How do I do this? I have to use some trick. Let's look at the simplest example of 8 free half hyper, so this theory. So no gauge group, SU2 cube global symmetry. And this is the Hilbert series. Since you have 8 free half hypers, and they transform in trifundamental, basically, what you do, you just stick Q together, right? And this is the PE, what PE did for you. The PE of this guy. And you get this rational function. Quite nice. Now, this form doesn't allow you to generalize anything. But if you expand it in power series, you can do it. And you get 1 plus the trifundamental, which is Q alpha beta gamma. And you have this, which is just nothing but 2Q sticking together. You write it as an infinite sum. What you get is the following, this general form. And this is, you can do this for all theory and generalize this to any G and E. And this is the form which allows you to do generalization. So let me point out what you have. You have lots of infinite sums, of course, but this is let you count operate to all order. Okay? You have 1 over 1 minus t to the 4 here. You have e plus 1 infinite sums. You have this structure, 2 terms in the sums. And this is the number of the node, the chi. So this is the general form of the Hilbert series. So you can see that theory with different G and E, sorry, theory, so even if you have a different graph with the same G and E, so for example, this dumbbell theory and this steering wheel theory, there are two different theories with the same G and E. So G equal to 2, E equal to 0. Even though the graphs are different, the same G and E, you get the same Hilbert series. This is why I propose that this is a primary check for the duality in this case. Okay? And actually, oh yes, this is what I draw. So let's look at a very interesting special case, zero external legs, E equal to 0. So examples are this. The hypermultiplet moduli space is 1/4 dimensional because it's E plus 1, if you can remember. So 0 plus 1 is 1. The Hilbert series, you can take it, and this simplifies a lot. You get this. And you can write it in this form. What does this Hilbert series tells you? It tells you that the moduli space is actually a complete intersection. Complete intersection, what does it mean? It means the following. You can read it off from here, that the generators are at orders 4, 2g minus 2, and 2g, subject to one relation at order 4g. Complete intersection because you have three generators and one relation, so 3 minus 1 equal to 2. And this is the complex dimension of the moduli space. So 1/4 equal to 2 complex. Okay? So this is the definition of the complete intersection moduli space. And luckily, for 1/4 dimensional, and we have n equal to 2 gauge theory. So this is, you know that the moduli space is a hyperkähler. Okay? Hyperkähler manifold. And with complex dimension 1, quaternary dimension 1, so there is an ADE classification. So you know that it must be an ADE orbifold of C2, at least one type. Now the only parameter you have in the theory is G here, and it's a complete intersection. The only two possibility you can have is A and D. But this Hilbert series is a fingerprint of the D-type orbifold. So trust, you have to take me on trust. This is a C2 mod DG plus 1. So just by looking at this Hilbert series and compare to the work that has been done, and you conclude that for any G with zero external leg, the hypermultiplet moduli space is C2 mod DG plus 1. So this is true for any genus. And this is... Well, there's a moduli space generically has a singularity anyway. In this case, it's an orbifold singularity. It's not, it usually moduli
space. When I just look at the graphs, how do I know if it's singular or not?
Oh, there is a moduli space. It's not a simple thing to just look at the Lagrange. So by looking at this graph, what this graph defines to you is a Lagrange, right? You have a look at the Lagrangian. You have no ways a priori to know whether your theory has a singularity or not. And generically, in almost 99% of supersymmetric gauge theory, if you make it non-trivial, there must be a singularity. Let me give you an example, like SQCD, for example. This is, even this, basically you have quark, so QCD. You supersymmetrize it. You already have a singularity, and that's where the field becomes massless. So in this case, I'm just pointing out that I can precisely talk about the moduli space of this class of theory to be the D-type orbifold.
And who becomes massless at this
point? The vectors.
Vectors?
So, sorry, in this case, hypermultiplet. We are on a hypermultiplet moduli space. So this hypermultiplet parameterized, this moduli space parameterized by the VEV of the hyper.
The vectors become massless.
Vector become massive. You have the U1 to the G.
No, but it becomes massless at the singularity.
Yeah, you have U1 to the G. Yes, okay. The moduli space story is a really, you can't stare it from the Lagrangian. There's no way you can
You can just look at the Lagrangian and say, what's the moduli space of these theories? This is why we have to develop two.
Okay. But suppose I look at your Hilbert series, mm-hmm. and you tell me all this stuff about generators and relation, and wouldn't I try then to write as polynomials of this order?
Oh, good, yes, okay.
We can do I think, what you say, order four, et cetera, is an order of polynomial, right?
Yeah, I think I showed you explicitly how to do this for some simple example. Okay, so let me give you.
Well, actually, maybe just that could be done. Perhaps you'd like to conclude so that people can.
Okay, it's just one last slide now. Okay, so I can talk to you afterwards. Okay, so a theory with one external length, we have seen, this is an example. So you have two quaternionic dimensional.
And the Hilbert series, again, look like this guy. Again, this is a complete intersection to quaternionic dimensional. So basically, you have operator at t to the 2 transform in the triplet of the global SU2. And at order t to the 2g minus 1, it transforms as the doublet of global SU2, and you have one relation at 4g. So, but this manifold is, I don't know whether, well, to my knowledge, I'm not sure there is a classification of hyperkalian manifold or dimension 2 quaternionic and complete intersection. So, but we can write down this operator. And, yeah. So, I would like to conclude this talk just like, okay, so we use Hilbert series to study moduli space of like, various n equal to 2 supersymmetric gauge theory. And surprisingly, this gives you lots of way of generalizing the result to all order, all G, all E. So, yeah, thank you very much for your attention. Yes, Coulomb branch, okay. So on the Coulomb branch, the Hilbert series itself is not so, well, it's not so insightful. Because what you have is you break the symmetry, the gauge symmetry, to U1 to the number of gauge group that you have. Now, because it's U1, you just stack everything up linearly. So basically, it's just C to the something. And the Hilbert series is insensitive to the quantum correction. So in that way, I would say Hilbert series is not useful for the computation on the Coulomb branch. You better use like the period, like in Seiberg-Whitman case, to compute the BPS spectrum on the Coulomb branch. I think that's for the Coulomb branch. This is my argument. I don't have much to say about it, but on the Higgs branch, as you can see, the results are quite powerful.
When you study this vector map, there are these walls. When you cross them, BPS spectrum changes. Can you have something like that for Coulomb?
This is the Coulomb.
This is the Coulomb branch. So you talk about wall crossing, right?
Yeah, but I'm asking if you can have wall crossing. Are there walls in
the Higgs branch?
In the other modular space, in this hypermodular space?
No, this. Now, it's a well known result due to Seiberg and Witten that the Higgs branch doesn't get quantum correction, and so basically you can do this is why I can do the computation and I can say that it's true for this kind of computation because they're, if you look at the metric you have no way to do quantum correction for the metric. And hyperkalian for the Coulomb branch and for the Higgs branch.
Sorry, I'm confused. Why do you say quantum corrections are related to wall crossing?
Well, so basically, what's interesting about on the Coulomb branch is that you have the massless monopole and diodes, right? This is the BPS spectrum that you are interested in. And basically, those are purely quantum, come from a quantum object. But you can see that at the singular point, those objects become massless. And you can talk about that. spectrum by looking at the free potential and that kind of thing. And that does come from quantum mechanical effect.
I understand that, but I don't see why is it obvious if there's no quantum correction to hypermodified model space, that there cannot be any walls separating different
Well, so
maybe I'm totally confused, but why cannot be, like, if you count some parallel operators here, but then...
Okay, so, where does the wall of marginal stabilities come in? You write down an equation, something like u equal to some function of lambda being the scale in your theory.
Okay.
But there's no such thing here. The scale lambda comes in, right? When you interesting effect with the scales come in when you consider quantum correction, there's no such thing here, as far as I can see.
Any questions? No, that's thank you.
Thank you.